Hi, my name is Dave Emery, and it's time once again for Hard Rain. Now, during the course of this broadcast, for the next half hour or so, we're going to be talking about something which is increasingly important in the political events of the world today and something not very many people know about, namely the profound and long-standing connections between Zionism and fascism. That's right, between Zionism and fascism. And if that seems like, well, I guess one might refer to it as perhaps strange bedfellows, stick around, you know, or if we're going to basically delineate some of those connections for later in the course of the program this evening. First of all, we're going to begin by taking a look at the long-standing physical and ideological association between the so-called Beit Harim, or revisionist Zionists, headed by, among others, Menachem Begin, and the Italian fascist regime of Benito Mussolini in Italy. Following that, we're going to take a look at Yitzhak Shamir's participation in an extreme right-wing Zionist group that actually advocated an open military alliance between the Third Reich and Zionist forces during the course of World War II. Following that, we're going to take a look at an early association between the SS and the Haganah, a very influential Zionist organization, which basically has been one of the linchpins of the Zionist movement over the years. And the SS and the Haganah actually worked out a pattern of cooperation. And this strange alliance is one of the things we're going to be taking a look at on the broadcast this evening. Now, we're going to begin, as I said, by taking a look at the physical and ideological associations between the so-called Beit Harim, or revisionist Zionist, and the Italian fascists, headed, of course, by Italian dictator Benito Mussolini. Now, the information that I'm about to present to you comes from an article that appeared in the Village Voice. The article was written by Alexander Coburn, last name C-O-C-K-B-U-R-N, and his Coburn's column is called History as the Propaganda of the Victors, and this column by Coburn was carried in the Village Voice article of October 12th, 1982. And by the way, research credit for this article goes to May Brussel, one of the finest assassination and anti-fascist researchers on the scene today, and was May who dug this article up for us. Once again, Alexander Coburn writing from the Village Voice of October 12th, 1982. For one of his recent reports from Israel for the New York Times, David Shipler interviewed the excellent Israeli journalist Amos Elon, last name E-L-O-N, and quoted Elon as referring to the Jewish face of fascism, unquote. Even tucked away at the end of the article, the use of the phrase was striking and brought to mind at once an uproar in August when I quoted here a famous letter to the New York Times signed by Albert Einstein, Hannah Arendt, and others protesting Begin's trip to the United States in 1948 and calling him and his party fascist. I was accused by Saul Stern of fascist baiting in these pages for citing the letter. So lest I be accused one day of shirking response to this charge, let us consider the background of the letter signed by Einstein et al. The ideology of Begin, his associates in the 1930s then thereafter, and the bulk of the revisionist movement within Zionism is a murky business. Until 1977, Begin was generally regarded as being on the lunatic fringe of Zionism, and after that date, he was rapidly liberated via Camp David and the Nobel Prize from the distasteful political and philosophical vestments of an earlier time. Einstein's attacks on Begin's fascism did not start in 1948, nor was it a matter of a woolly-minded physicist being recruited to revile Begin without any awareness of internal Zionist affairs. Einstein, himself a moderate Zionist, had been attacking revisionism, i.e. the movement which Begin now leads and which has always been the most militarist and rightist element in Zionism, militaristic and rightist element in Zionism, at least as far back as 1935. Why? A moderate Zionist like Einstein could, in 1935, point to the following characteristics of the revisionists. Now, I'm going to sum up the basics of this before proceeding with Coburn's text here, so you get some idea of just what Coburn is talking about before we get into it, because there's a lot of information presented here, and lest some of it go by you, I'd like to give you basically two chances to pick this up. Now, basically, the Beit Harim, spelled B-E-T-A-R-I-M, or the revisionist Zionists, were an explicit fascist wing in the Zionist movement. That is to say, the international movement to get all of the Jews, or most Jews, to return to their biblical homeland of Palestine. Okay? Now, basically, the Beit Harim, or revisionist Zionists, represented a fascist element within the Zionist movement. And among the things they did, they basically wore brown shirt uniforms. They associated and, in fact, took military training from Mussolini's naval cadets. Basically, they had a training school set up in Italy under the auspices of Il Duce, and basically they received military training at this school. They were reviewed by Mussolini himself, and they gave the fascist salute. They sang the Italian fascist anthem, And their leader, a fellow by the name of Yabotinsky at that time, made it very clear that they were doing this because they felt had a strong affinity with the organization. They did not associate with Mussolini's fascists out of any felt sense of... basically because they felt obliged to in any way. They associated with Mussolini because they enjoyed his political views, and they felt to themselves to be affiliated with those kinds of views. And it's interesting that the Beitarim basically saw Zionism as the embodiment of the inherent superiority, what they felt to be the inherent superiority of light-skinned peoples over dark-skinned peoples. In other words, they saw the rise to power, one might say, of the Jews in the Middle East as basically a manifestation of some form of racial superiority. They were particularly supportive of Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia, which they saw as a similar sort of phenomenon. In other words, they saw the Italians conquering the Ethiopians as a manifestation of the racial doctrine which they believed in, which was, as I said, explicitly racist and explicitly fascist. And it's worth noting, too, that the Beitarim did not work against the anti-Semitic regime of Poland. Rather, they encouraged Jews to travel to the Middle East. So keep in mind all the things I just mentioned. I'm going to read the actual text in which Coburn presents this information. Now, bear in mind that Coburn's information, in turn, comes from an article, a letter, I should say, written to the New York Times by Albert Einstein, among others, in 1948. Continuing here with Coburn's accounting of the fascist wing within the Zionist movement, that is to say, the Beitarim. Coburn writes, "A moderate Zionist like Einstein could in 1935 point to the following characteristics of the revisionists. They had brown shirt uniforms. They had a naval training school in Civitavecchia from 1934 to 1937 set up by Mussolini. In 1936, revisionist cadets, known as Beitarim, were reviewed by Il Duce himself. The March 1936 issue of L'Idea Sionistica describes the ceremonies inaugurating the new headquarters. The Beitarim commander ordered the triple chant, Vive l'Italia, vive il re, and vive il Duce. In other words, long live Italy, long live the king, long live il Duce, Mussolini. After which the Beitarim lustily sang the Italian fascist anthem. The revisionist leader, Vladimir Yabotinsky, deliberately stressed that it had not been necessary to have the school in Mussolini's Italy, where they were trained by the blackshirts. It had been a matter of choice. Einstein or any well-informed political person could have quoted the financial director of the revisionist movement, Wolfgang von Wiesel, last name V-O-N-W-E-I-S-L, a good friend of Begin, as saying, as reported by a London Zionist paper World Jewry for June 12, 1936, that, quote, although opinions among the revisionists varied, in general they sympathized with fascism. He personally was a supporter of fascism, and he rejoiced at the victory of fascist Italy in Abyssinia as a triumph of the white races against the black. Where was Begin in all of this? Begin was the fire-eater of the revisionists, one of the most militarist-minded. Yabotinsky found his ranting to be, quote, the useless screeching of a door, unquote. In 1939, Begin became head of the Polish Beitar. The revisionist Irgun was being trained in Poland at Zakopane by the anti-Semitic Polish army in explosives, underground methods, and so forth. In return for this instruction, revisionists told the Jews of Poland not to struggle against the anti-Semitic regime, but to pack up and leave for Palestine. Of course, the overwhelming majority rejected. Begin escaped from Warsaw in September of 1939 in the company of his close friend Nathan Yellin Moore, last name Yellin hyphen M-O-R, editor of one of the revisionist Warsaw newspapers. Fleeing to Lithuania, Begin was imprisoned by the Soviet secret police, sent to Siberia, and only reached Palestine in 1942. Yellin Moore arrived well before Begin and joined the so-called Stern Gang, unquote, a split-off from the Irgun. The Irgun, by the way, was a underground paramilitary organization conducting, paramilitary or terrorist activities, depending on your ideological orientation or which side you were on, in Palestine before, during, and after World War II. Continuing here with Coburn's account, in 1941, Begin was one of the couriers for the Stern Gang's proposal for a wartime alliance with Hitler's Germany, portions of which follow. The following document was found after the war in the files of the German embassy in Ankara and is quoted in full in German in David Yisraeli's Hebrew PhD thesis, The Palestine Problem in German Politics, 1889 to 1945. It is quoted and discussed against the context of the entire period in Leni Brenner's forthcoming Zionism in the Age of the Dictators. The German memorandum on the document is dated January 11th, 1941. At this point, Abraham Stern called his movement the Real Irguns Vayleumi, or National Military Organization, abbreviated NMO. I'm not going to go into the text of this memorandum right at this point. It basically is sort of typically turgid fascist prose, but it makes very clear that the NMO, the Real Irguns Vayleumi, the National Military Organization, believed very strongly that basically they felt a strong affiliation with Nazi Germany, and that basically they saw Nazi Germany's policies towards the Jews as being consistent with their own. In other words, they saw German racialism as being beneficial to Zionism, and they sought a pattern of cooperation whereby the Third Reich would basically help them get German Jews out of Germany and into Palestine, and they in return would support the Third Reich's foreign policy goals. In particular, the so-called Stern Gang, the NMO, was very much preoccupied with attempting to undermine the British, basically undermine Britain's Middle East empire, which of course the Germans coveted. So it was in the interest not only of the Nazis to weaken Britain's Mid-East empire, but also of the Zionists as well, and they cooperated at least to a certain extent toward that end. Now, Coburn here mentions that the actual military alliance between the Stern Gang and the Third Reich never actually took place, but we're going to take a look at an actual working link between the SS and the Haganah, one of the most important Zionist organizations, here in a minute. Now, after the section of Coburn's column in which he quotes the memorandum detailing a pattern of cooperation, or a proposed pattern of political and military cooperation between the Irgun, the NMO, and Nazi Germany, basically Coburn goes on to describe not only Begin's continued fascist activities on behalf of Zionism, but very significantly the presence in this Stern group, this NMO group, which advocated an alliance between Zionism and the Third Reich, of Yitzhak Shamir. Now, Yitzhak Shamir is currently the Israeli foreign minister, and he too has fascist origins, as Coburn writes in his column. By the time Begin arrived in Palestine, the notion of such an alliance with the Nazis was obviously horrifyingly ludicrous. Instead of joining his friend Yellen Moore at the Stern Gang, Begin went into the Irgun, the main revisionist military organization. But it is to be emphasized that Avraham Stern and Yellen Moore were not alone in proposing this alliance, that is to say, interrupting Coburn's text here, that is, the alliance between Zionism and Nazi Germany. The triumvirate which took over Stern's group after he was shot by the British in 1942 consisted of Yellen Moore, along with Yitzhak Shamir, the present foreign minister of Israel, and Israel Shaib Eldad, last name Scheib-Eldad, a prominent leader today of the extreme right Tehiva party, which recently became part of the Begin coalition with Yuval Ne'eman, see Israel's Real Strategy in the 80s. That, by the way, is from Annals of the Age of Reagan, the Village Voice issue of July 27th. Continuing here with Coburn's text, is it fascist baiting to cite this background? In my view, no. Let's remain agnostic about Sharon, but Israel today is not a fascist state. In distinction to the tyrannies which surrounded Israel as a democracy for Jews and a dictatorship over Arabs, using repressive legal apparatus taken over from the British. On the other hand, the revisionists in the 1930s admired fascism in Italy. Even Jabotinsky, more cautious than his maximalist lieutenants, still apologized for it. The revisionists believed in the corporate state, militarism, and terrorism against their political opponents. They favored the outlawing of strikes. They were racist in the strict sense of favoring the separation of Jews and non-Jews. Israel's present entente with South Africa is not a new development. For the revisionists, for decades, the strongest Zionist faction, Begin was head of the Israel-South Africa Friendship Society before he became prime minister. And you recall that we've looked at the close links between the Bruderbond, the inner core of the South African National Party, and the Third Reich. Recall that a Third Reich agent basically was instrumental in helping to reorganize the Bruderbond, the core of the Nationalist Party in South Africa, along the lines of the Nazi Party in Germany. So it's interesting that we have Menachem Begin so closely affiliated with South Africa as well as with the fascist elements in Zionism. Now, the proposed military alliance between the NMO and the Third Reich, between that element of Zionism and the Third Reich, never actually took place to any significant extent, at least not that I have become aware of. However, it's interesting to note that there was an actual working pattern of cooperation established between the SS and the Haganah, one of the main Zionist organizations, and that basically both the Haganah and the SS were working together for some time to promote the policy of Jewish emigration to Israel. And we're going to take a look at this in just a second. Now, the information I'm going to present here comes from a book called The Order of the Death's Head, The Story of Hitler's SS. And The Order of the Death's Head was authored by a German anti-fascist writer named Heinz Hoene, whose last name is spelled H-O-H-N-E. And Hoene's The Order of the Death's Head was published in paperback by Ballantine Books, and its first copyright is 1966. And in The Order of the Death's Head, Hoene describes the policy of the SS towards the Jews, the pre-Final Solution attitude, before the Nazis came up with the idea, and which, of course, they put into practice, of exterminating the Jews, gassing them in the concentration camps. Basically, the Nazis worked to promote Jewish immigration to Palestine, and basically they sought to do a couple of things through this. First of all, they wanted to get all the Jews out of Germany, which, of course, is one of their main goals, since they were profoundly anti-Semitic. Secondly, and not unimportantly, they sought to drive a wedge, as I said before, into Britain's Mideast Empire, thereby weakening, and of course, the Nazis hoped to basically take over Britain's Middle East holdings eventually, and they saw the growing Jewish state in the Middle East as a strong wedge to help out that particular policy aim of the Third Reich. And as Hoene points out here in The Order of the Death's Head, apparently Zionist elements in Germany also found, initially, many of them found the racist policies of the Third Reich and Hitler to be beneficial to their situation because they felt it would stimulate Jewish immigration to Palestine. And so they were initially, so many elements of the German Zionist community were rather sympathetic, if not sympathetic, to Nazism in and of itself, saw it as a beneficial thing for them, and so they didn't argue against it. This is delineated in The Order of the Death's Head by Hoene as follows. For the Jewish nationalists, the prospect was tempting. Under the pressure of German racialism and with its assistance, the Zionist ideal might win that victory denied it in the humanitarian and democratic atmosphere of the Weimar Republic. If both the Zionists and the National Socialists regarded race and nationhood as universally valid, some common ground must be discoverable between the two. As early as the 13th of June, 1933, the Jüdische Rundschau had come out into the open, quote, Zionism recognizes the existence of a Jewish problem and desires a far-reaching and constructive solution. For this purpose, Zionism wishes to obtain the assistance of all peoples, whether pro or anti-Jewish, because in its view, we are dealing here with a concrete rather than a sentimental problem and in the solution of which all peoples are interested. Next, Hoene goes on to describe an SS man named von Mildenstein's work in promoting this active cooperation between Zionist elements in Germany and the Third Reich. And apparently the efforts on the part of Mildenstein were quite successful, and there the official SS policy to the Jews became changed from one of diehard and all-encompassing anti-Semitism to one of open sympathy for Zionist elements in Germany. Interestingly enough, the SS apparently even provided strong logistical support to training centers for Jewish youth to be sent to work in the kibbutzim in the Middle East, the collective agricultural developments in Palestine. This pattern of cooperation between the SS and German Zionists is basically presented here by Hoene as follows. Keep in mind now, von Mildenstein is the SS man in charge of Jewish affairs at this point in the development of the Third Reich. At this point, von Mildenstein stepped in. The task of the SD, by the way, the SD is the SS Intelligence Service. Beginning again, the task of the SD, he argued, was to turn the German assimilated Jews back into conscious Jews, to promote dissimilation in order to awaken in the breasts of the largest possible number of Jews the urge to go to Palestine, the only country open at the time to large-scale Jewish immigration. Himmler seized on Mildenstein's plan and set him to work. Within the SD Hauptamt, Mildenstein set up a Jewish desk entitled 2112. A period of SS Jewish policy began in which, according to Hans Lahm, last name L-A-M-M, quote, the adoption or affectation of a pro-Zionist attitude was in order, unquote. This new SS policy made its first appearance in the columns of the Schwarze Corps. In place of the paper's anti-Jewish tirades, references began to appear to the sensible, totally unsentimental Jew of the Zionist movement. The paper forecast, quote, The time cannot be far distant when Palestine will again be able to accept its sons who have been lost to it for over 1,000 years. Our good wishes, together with our official goodwill, go with them. Although Jewish emigration to Palestine was officially the responsibility of the Gestapo and the Reich Ministry of the Interior, the SD now began to force the pace. Between 1933 and 1937, 24,000 Jews had left for Palestine. The SD now increased its pressure upon those still willing to emigrate. Von Mildenstein gave all possible support to the Zionist organization's retraining camps, where young Jews were trained for the farm work which they would have to do in Palestine's kibbutzim. He kept close watch on the work of the Zionists and maintained large-scale maps in his office showing the progress of Zionism among German Jewry. Well, the final element that I'd like to present to you basically concerns the close affiliation and, in fact, a working relationship that was established between the SS and specifically the SD, the Sicherheitsdienst, and the Haganah, which was basically a Zionist defense organization which incorporated, among other things, a very effective and important worldwide Zionist espionage system. Okay? Basically, it was sort of, among other things, the Zionist intelligence wing. And basically, a working relationship was established here between the SS and a Haganah man named Fivel Polkesh, last name P-O-L-K-E-S. And apparently Polkesh was able to make contact with several of the SS leaders in charge of Jewish matters, notably Adolf Eichmann, later executed for his part in exterminating European Jews. And basically Polkesh, Eichmann, and another SS man named Albert Hagen, at that point Eichmann's superior, were put in contact with Fivel Polkesh by a guy named Otto von Bolschwing. Now, Otto von Bolschwing is a fellow we're going to talk about at some length in the future on Hard Rain. Basically, he was also at one point Adolf Eichmann's superior in administering the Jewish affairs for the SS, and von Bolschwing later went on to become head of Reinhard Gehlen's North American operation. You recall that Gehlen was Hitler's chief of intelligence for the Eastern Front, who then jumped with his entire organization to the CIA, and then in turn to NATO, and finally to West Germany, where Gehlen's organization, the organization he founded, is the West German Intelligence Service to this day. Okay, and Otto von Bolschwing, the fellow who formed the contact between the Haganah and the SS, became head of Gehlen's entire North American operation. Okay, beginning here with Hirner's account of the working relationship established between Fivel Polkesh, acting on behalf of the Haganah and the SS, Hirner writes as follows. Mere control of the Zionists in Germany, however, did not satisfy Hagen and Eichmann. If they were really to estimate the chances of formation of a Jewish state, they had to force their way into the nerve center of the Zionist movement itself. The opportunity to do so came via an old friend of von Mildenstein. This was Otto von Bolschwing, last name V-O-N-B-O-L-S-C-H-W-I-N-G-H, a party member, an SD informer, and an experienced salesman in the motor trade. Von Bolschwing was in contact with a group of Palestinian Germans who lined their pockets by certain extramural intelligence activities. Among them was Dr. Reichert, the German news agency's Jerusalem correspondent. Reichert, in turn, possessed contacts with one of the leaders of a secret Zionist organization, the Haganah, which, with the exception of the British intelligence service, fascinated the SD more than any other institution. Eichmann's comment on the Haganah in his 1936 brochure had been, quote, "All parties and formations included in the Zionist World Organization are kept under observation by a central counter-espionage and supervisory office, which plays an extraordinarily important role in Jewish political life." This office is known as Haganah, translated self-defense. The Haganah was not only the Jewish settlers' military defense organization, but in addition, maintained a widespread espionage system. On the headquarters staff of this secret army, there was a chartered accountant named Fivel Polkesh, last name P-O-L-K-E-S, born in Poland on the 11th of September 1900, who drew considerable sums for Dr. Reichert for occasional scraps of information. Polkesh carried the rank of commander in the Haganah and, according to Hagen, was responsible for, quote, "running the entire self-defense organization of the Palestinian Jews." I'm going to repeat that last sentence. This fellow Polkesh, who worked with the SS, as we're going to see in a minute, quote, according to Albert Hagen, was responsible for running the entire self-defense organization of the Palestinian Jews. Now, the next section of Hona's text here basically delineates the contact between Polkesh, Eichmann, and Hagen, and basically indicates that Polkesh not only was willing to work with the SD, with the SS intelligence service, but basically that he was acting here in his capacity as an official representative of the Haganah, that basically the policy he was putting into effect represented official Haganah policy. Hunter writes as follows. Section 2112 evinced interest in the Haganah commander, and in February 1937, Polkish journeyed to Berlin. On the 26th of February, he and Eichmann met. On the first occasion, Eichmann entertained him at the Trauba restaurant near the zoo. During the return match, Polkish invited Eichmann to Palestine. Polkish was, of course, no ordinary agent. His object, he explained to Eichmann, was to accelerate Jewish immigration into Palestine so that the Jews in their homeland might outnumber the Arabs. For this purpose, he was already working with the British and French secret services and was only too willing to cooperate with Hitler Germany. On the 17th of June, 1937, Eichmann's office noted, quote, he, Polkish, was prepared, among other things, to give powerful support to German foreign policy interests in the Middle East, on condition that German currency regulations were relaxed for Jews emigrating to Palestine. Gradually, the SD realized that Polkish had not made the journey to Berlin on his own initiative. He was patently representing the immigration policy of the Haganah. Eichmann minuted, quote, as a quid pro quo, the following assurances could be given to Polkish. Pressure would be exerted upon the German Jewish settlers to place an obligation on all Jews emigrating from Germany to go to Palestine and not to any other country. Such a measure is completely in line with German interests, and preparatory steps have already been taken by the Gestapo. At 8:50 a.m. on the 26th of September, 1937, Eichmann and Hagen boarded a train and set off to crown these first cautious steps toward an SS-Haganah alliance. Okay, so the Zionist-fascist connection is not nearly as obscure as it might appear, and it, in fact, is quite well documented. That basically winds up the broadcast for this evening. Before officially wrapping things up, I'd like to take just a couple of minutes and review what we've looked at. You'll recall that we began by looking at a column by Alexander Coburn, The Village Voice, where he, in turn, quoted some material presented by Albert Einstein, among others, in the New York Times in 1948. This represented a criticism of Menachem Begin and his Beit Harim, his revisionist Zionist party. Basically, the revisionist Zionists not only dressed in brown shirt fascist uniforms, they trained with Mussolini's naval cadets. A special naval cadet training school was set up for them by Il Duce. Il Duce reviewed them in 1936. They gave the fascist salute, sang the fascist anthem, and their leaders indicated that the cooperation with Mussolini was not done out of any felt sense of obligation, but rather because they, the Beit Harim, felt an affinity with Mussolini. And it's worth noting, too, that the racist attitudes peculiar to fascism, which characterized fascism, cropped up also with regard to the Beit Harim, the revisionist Zionists. They saw Zionism as represententing the triumph of light-skinned peoples over dark-skinned peoples, and many of them were very vocally supportive of Mussolini's invasion of Ethiopia, as we've seen. Following that, we took a look at a proposed wartime military alliance between the so-called NMO, the real Irgun, and the Third Reich. Now, although this alliance does not appear to have blossomed to any significant extent, there was an earlier pre-war alliance between the SS Intelligence Service, the SD, and the Haganah. Initially, of course, as we looked at in the Hunter text, the Zionist elements in Germany began an active pattern of cooperation with the Third Reich for a while, because they felt that the Third Reich's racist policies would in turn benefit their own desire to force or to bring about Jewish immigration from Germany to Israel. So for a while, German Zionists were very supportive of the SS, and in turn, as we saw from Hunter's material, the SS themselves supported Zionism, and official support for the Zionist movement became SS policy at one point. We also took a look at this last section here, in which an actual working relationship was established between some of the highest officials of Amt 4B, the SS section which attended to the Jews, and the Haganah, the self-defense organization of the Zionists. And specifically, we took a look at cooperation between a man named Fievel Polkisch, like Menachem Begin, a Polish Jew, and not only Adolf Eichmann, but Albert Hagen as well. This contact having been set up by another SS man we're going to be dealing with in the future, a man named Otto von Bolschwing. But a lot of strange material, a lot of things you may not have known before, but worth keeping all these things in mind as you see some of the developments in the Middle East. Zionism, like all other political movements, is relatively complex, and certainly there are many elements within it, and it is very, very important in light of Begin's preeminence in Israeli political life today to realize the fascist origins and fascist instincts of that Zionist wing represented by Menachem Begin, and keep in mind their connections with the Third Reich as well and some of these working relationships that were established. All very strange material, perhaps, to some of you, but all very important and worth keeping in mind. That concludes the broadcast for today. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.